Welcome back to another episode of We the 66. This is the official podcast of the 66% of Americans who do not trust the news. And today we bring you an unbelievably powerful conversation with one of the first doctors to visit Gaza after the October 7th attacks. Now, he went in December, but then returned in March, so you'll be hearing about both of his visits. And to say that this conversation was emotionally moving would be an understatement. Max and I sat idle in our chairs for minutes after it concluded. So we look forward to sharing it with you, and thank you again to Dr. Hassan for coming on. Now, there is one important note to make, which is that Dr. Hassan called from his Duke University office, and the audio ended up being very, very, very muffled. This is what his voice sounded like.
They told me about cases that needed to be operated on. And so we went and started operating. I was shocked by the lack of...
So, yeah, not ideal. And that's why, with Dr. Hassan's consent, we decided to use an AI-generated voice for his transcript. So that will hopefully make your listening experience more enjoyable. And by the way, thank you again for your support in these early weeks. We've just been overwhelmed with all the emails you've sent in to wethe66@rokanews.com, all the DMs you've sent. It's been really incredible, and it's just chapter one. We have so many more conversations coming, and thank you again. We are so lucky to have the Roka Riders. But without further ado, here's a conversation with Dr. Hassan. Dr. Hassan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we want to begin with your story, and really, you know, we came across it online of you visiting Gaza in December, and sort of out of a humanitarian interest. But could you talk, just give us a little background on why you went to Gaza, how you got there, and what it was like?
Oh, thanks, Max. Actually, I've been to Gaza twice already now. The first time in late December, we entered on December 24th and left January 1st. And the second time I entered was March 18th, so I've been there twice so far. In December, we were the first group to enter Gaza after October 7th. For a long period of time since October 7th, no one was allowed to enter Gaza, at least from the Rafah crossing, which is the border between Gaza and Egypt. And it was the only border open at that time for at least a humanitarian reason. You know, watching the news unfolding, whether in the mainstream media or on social media, it's just so heartbreaking to see all that's happened there from both sides, especially October 7th for the Israelis, and also the people in Gaza after that. Both sides are still suffering. The Israelis still have their hostages that they have not been released. And for the people in Gaza, they continue to have the bombing and the shelling and continuous injuries on top of their famine. So that's how my wife and I thought about it, and we wanted to help after the war. We never thought we'd go to Gaza during the war. But in December, there was a resolution being contemplated by the UN Security Council, which was a ceasefire. But the United States converted it to more of an aid resolution. After that, the borders for medical missions to enter. And that's when I, within a week, dropped everything and traveled to Cairo.
So what is the process to physically, at least when you went in December, what was the process to physically get into Gaza?
So remember, at that time, Gaza was a war zone, and no one knew exactly what is the process, the logistics, going from Cairo all the way to Rafah. You don't know what you're going to face at all. So what happened is we flew to Cairo. I flew with a Turkish airline. Once we got to Cairo, we met at a hotel. And the next morning, there were three teams, a team from the United States and Canada, which included six doctors, four from the United States and two from Canada, then 12 from England, MAP, which is medical aid for Palestinians. And so we all gathered there at 5 o'clock, and we traveled to Rafah. The trip itself was about 6-7 hours by car, but the 11 checkpoints made it much longer. And we have to stop at
Egyptian government checkpoints.
Correct. We had to wait 5 hours at one checkpoint to get the approval from the foreign ministry and the military. So the trip itself ended up being about 12 hours. Before arriving to Rafah for about 10 miles, there were about, I would say, hundreds, if not thousands, of 18-wheelers or lorries parked on both sides. Seeing that itself was heartbreaking. Some of them waited for a week, or some of them went up to 2 or 3 weeks. So once we got to Rafah, we went through the Egyptian side and then the Palestinian side.
When you arrived in Palestine, in Gaza, where were you taken? Where did you stay? And what were you feeling at this point?
So that's a good question. As soon as we entered the Palestinian side, I literally thought we were just going to hear bombing, shelling, and smoke. We traveled in an ambulance for safety. And as we were driving, we saw, I would say, maybe 40 to 50% of the buildings either completely or partially destroyed. After about 15 minutes, we got close to the hospital. It was about 250 beds, and as we entered the camp and stayed there, we saw this ocean of people just living and walking around there. The hospital premise is considered the safest of all the places in Gaza, even though some of them got injured in some of the other hospitals. And once we got to the hospital, we were taken inside, and it was shocking to see almost, I would say, 40, 50,000 people living within the premise of the hospital and inside the hospital. We got there about maybe noon to 1 o'clock. And again, all I can hear is the drones making a buzzing sound like bees, but no bombing, no shelling.
So then as soon as you get into the hospital, do you get to work? Do you start treating patients, or what do you do next?
As soon as we got there, I met the neurosurgery team. And as we moved things, they put us in a small room and gave us bottled water. And I met the team, and they told me about cases that needed to be operated on. And so we went and started operating. I was shocked by the lack of medical support, especially for a hospital that's still standing and functioning. There's a lack of a lot of supplies, equipment, devices, anesthetics, and pain medications. It was heartbreaking. I'll tell you why in a second. So we started operating. Because of the condition, the lack of water and anesthetics, the sewage and overcrowded system, it was a perfect environment for infection. So most of these patients, I would even say 70 or 80% of these, got infected and were lost in the infection.
How did you communicate with the doctors? Everyone speak English or?
Yeah, they all spoke English. And I would speak in Arabic too because of my heritage. But mostly I spoke in English and was able to communicate. The surgeons there were actually excited because they wanted to practice their English. They were the most kind, hospitable people.
Who else was in your group? Who entered Gaza with you in that 12-hour journey across checkpoints and into Rafah?
6 people from the US and Canada. We have a cardiothoracic surgeon and a trauma surgeon from Canada. In the United States, we have 2 orthopedics, trauma orthopedics, myself, a neurosurgeon, and also a medical doctor. From the English-based group, the medical aid for Palestinians, there were 12, mainly orthopedics and plastic surgeons.
So just a few quick questions to kind of set the scene here. Was there electricity?
No electricity. The hospital had some electricity, occasionally no electricity, and intermittent internet. At night, I had to operate with a flashlight sometimes. The water situation was not great either. At one point, I had to operate without washing my hands. By 7 o'clock, it was evening, and that's when the heavy bombardment started, almost within 1 mile of the hospital. And at one point, because of the shock of it, I almost fell over. And this continued all night until about sunrise, and then things stopped again. And that was for 7 days. I couldn't sleep for the first couple days due to the sound. But after 3, 4 days, I became jaded to everything else. I operated at the European Gaza Hospital, and I did a few operations at Nasser Hospital, which was surrounded by Israeli troops. They then entered the compound, and it's not functioning at this point.
How close did the artillery come to the hospital itself? Did you ever feel immediately threatened?
At times, it felt like it was in your backyard. One time I was in the on-call room and one of the air conditioners fell off and literally the room completely shakes. Remember, some of the artillery are the dumb bombs, the 2,000-pound bombs from the United States, the 2,000 pounds. And those, when they go off, usually create a crater the size of a football field, but the destruction is almost 10 football field. So even if you are a mile away from the hospital itself, just the vibration, the waves, carries through the distance.
Did you have any concerns about... A major thing people are talking about now is the use of human shields and the tunnels that are alleged to have been built under, you know, hospitals, schools, various things like that. Did you have any fear, for example, that there was a tunnel underneath the hospital and that that could come under attack? Or, yeah.
One, I've never seen the tunnels. And two, while I was there, even I operated in 2 hospitals the first time. The second time I operated only in 1 hospital. And in both times, I did not see any weapons or see any Hamas fighters. Now, was I aware of the possibility? Absolutely, I was concerned. And when we entered Gaza, we had to sign a waiver. If something happened to us, my family could not sue the UN, the WHO, or the NGO because it's on your own risk, especially in December.
Were most of your patients women and children? Were many fighters themselves? What was the typical profile, and how many did you treat? Was it a chaotic swarm in the hospital, or was it orderly and more NGO run?
No, it was chaotic. By demographics, half of Gaza's population are kids, less than 18 years old. And so the casualties, unfortunately, were all of them. And the ones I operated on, I would say 70-80% are women and kids.
70-80% women and kids. What were the typical injuries?
So, let me add a little bit to that. During December, as I told you, during December, the bombing started at 7 and lasted from sunset to sunrise. So, if people got bombed, they had to stay in their spot until the next morning, when all the ambulances could come in and pick up the injured people. And a lot of them, too, got on cars, were tugged by donkeys, since there aren't many cars. So by the time they got to us, these injured people were already in the final stages of not surviving. And the injuries are really horrific, very graphic. Missing limbs, burns, you name it. But not only that, remember, the European Gaza hospital at this point was barely running, because the physicians, the nurses, all of us are fatigued and tired. They've been working almost non-stop. For some of them, 2 months or 3 months of non-stop work. And so, they're very fatigued. The resources are minimal, the supplies are minimal, the ICU beds are limited, the operating room is limited. So when you have 20, 30 people coming to you, you have to decide which one is going to survive and which one is going to let go. So because the number of resources you have is very limited, there are some injuries that we think can be survivable in the United States or the surrounding countries like Israel or Jordan or Egypt, but wouldn't be in Gaza. We had to let them go because we have limited ICU beds, limited ventilators, and limited operating room access. The whole hospital, if you will, has only one CAT scan, doesn't have MRI, doesn't have anything. So you have to line them up one by one and then make a decision to go up to the operating room. And sometimes you just lack supplies, like an endotracheal tube, so you have to take it from someone who cannot survive and give it to someone who could survive.
So you were in Gaza in December and March, correct?
Yes.
How was it different going back in March after being there in December?
Much. Huge difference. Number one, the hospital became a little bit overloaded. So most people now are squeezed to Rafah, which now has an estimation of 1.5 million people. Also, the number of or percentage of buildings now destroyed was much higher in March. Distracted by them is much higher. I would say 70% or 80% destroyed. The supplies had gotten better. In terms of medical supplies, at least, they were much better compared to December. So, in March, there was now access to anesthetics, access to some pain medication and some antibiotics. So, those were the main differences. In terms of bombing and shelling, it was less in Khan Yunis, because by then the Israeli troops had already had almost full control of Khan Yunis. The only thing left for them was Rafah, which is still today preparing for that. So because of that, the bombing and shelling was more targeted, if you will. There was also some normalization by March, but in a very abnormal way. In December, people were so worried about surviving and sheltering. In March, you could see some commercial life, if you will, because a lot of the trucks were able to enter by then. They were allowing more aid. And so, people are using that commercial product, especially the business people who would sell the products. But the problem is the lack of a government. So, it's become a wild, wild west, no law and order. And so it was the survival of the fittest, if you will.
How do you see that play out?
It means that when some of the 18-wheelers of aid came in, because the people are starving, some of them haven't had food or water for days. And for that matter, too, people had gone months without even a shower or cleaning themselves because there's no access to water. So when the trucks arrive, people just jump on the trucks and try to get some food. The fastest and strongest gets the most, and the weakest doesn't.
When you are around patients and just getting a measure of sentiment there, to what extent are the residents resentful of Israel versus Hamas?
First of all, what I'm emphasizing to both of you is that the people in Gaza are human beings. And like you and I, they have stories, they have names, they have aspirations, and they want to live exactly the same thing as you and I want. They want to live in dignity and respect, have a house and shelter for their kids and provide for their kids. That's their dream. Unfortunately, the war between Hamas and the Israeli troops and government put these innocent people in the middle. A lot of them, if you will, and I can't put a percentage to it, but a lot of them, the ones that I talked to, they didn't want to do anything with this war. At all. And because of that, they felt very trapped. They are collateral damage. Almost every single one of them either lost a home or lost people within the families. And so, of course, they're going to be resentful for the whole war and the players of that war, and anyone causing anything their pain or causing those forces. If you lose your family, your life savings, you don't have access to anything. You're living in a tent. You don't have access to water or to food. Your kids are starving and haven't eaten for days. You can see them dying, if not from the infection, because there's no way to take care of anything but the trauma. And there were about 1 million people getting infected either by upper respiratory infections, hepatitis A, diarrhea. And I myself got COVID on the first trip. And the second trip, I had severe gastritis. So when you're experiencing that, you are definitely resentful for the people who are the cause or are inflicting it on you.
Had you ever been to Gaza before this war?
No.
Do you have a sense, with the anarchy that you mentioned that now rules in the Gaza Strip, what will come next? Do the doctors there kind of speculate what will follow this or how the war could end and what will replace Hamas? Or is you guys are too busy to think about that?
I mean, you hear the news, and I've been very involved in trying to facilitate the humanitarian aid to Gaza. And I've been fortunate that I work with the Israeli NGOs, and until today, I still work with an Israeli NGO. One of the projects that we're working on is to take units that convert human air, atmospheric air, into drinkable water. One unit is the size of a small car and can produce 1,000 liters of water. And we are now working on this project to bring it into northern Gaza. No one knows what's going to happen in the next 4 to 6 weeks. I think the Israelis have already made the decision. They've built a new camp in Khan Yunis, with about 40,000 tents in Khan Yunis. They're ready to move based on the United States' request, all these people from Rafah. They will not invade Rafah. The Prime Minister of Israel is very determined, 2704 in the war camp. It's just a matter of when. At one point, that border with Egypt that we all cross through may close permanently, because the Israelis think that's where all the weapons are coming from, and they want to take full control.
Dr. Sam, what is the morale like on the ground, specifically with such a scarcity of resources where, as you said, some residents of Gaza hadn't eaten for days, sleeping in terrible conditions? Are they fighting over resources? Did you see moments of unity? Was it a more complicated story? How were the interactions of those in these dire conditions?
So you have to keep in mind geographically, there's northern Gaza, which is completely isolated from southern Gaza. And the resources of northern Gaza is much, much, much worse than middle and southern Gaza. So when you look at this, you have to separate the two areas completely. Because of the pressure on our president, Joe Biden, and Netanyahu, things are much better in terms of aid. Now the Israelis opened the northern border to Erez. They opened the Ashdod port. And as we heard from the State of the Union speech, the president committed to building a pier where the aid can enter. So there's a lot of aid coming. Before the war, there was about 500 trucks entering on a daily basis. And that's when things are stable to some extent. Now, with the destruction until recently, the last 2 or 3 weeks, there were only about 150 trucks that entered. So they're already way behind, and according to the World Food Programme, about 1.1 million people are at the level 5 of famine, which is the highest level. And that's the number that scared most countries and actually changed the attitude of our president. I speculate, that's my speculation. The problem is that now, people are dispersing into pockets, except for Rafah, where you have 1.5 million. And there's an absence of law and order, or governing bodies. So you have this aid coming in. Wow, do you distribute it? Who's going to monitor where it's going to go? Who is going to make sure that these pockets of people are getting the distribution? So there is a need for better coordination of that. The World Central Commission kind of got involved and wanted to help and wanted to do that. But as you know, unfortunately, their 7 members got killed. And because of that, they stopped that. And some other NGOs too are scared. I mean, if you have an NGO, you want to guarantee your employees' safety. And if you can't, that's a problem. So there's a total vacuum, if you will, of who's going to distribute that. And if you leave it to the people, some are good, as you know, at any part, who will care for each other and help each other and feed each other. But there's some who are going to take advantage of the opportunity of that situation.
Did you get any sense from the stories you heard or your own experience firsthand to the degree to which the bombing was indiscriminate, as in civilians were just killed without much respect for them, without much regard for them, or the extent to which people, there was an effort made to evacuate people before the bombing began?
So there's at least that I experienced or heard there are times where it was coordinated, where they dropped flyers in the neighborhood. They dropped flyers, and then we get SMS. But remember, there's no electricity, there's no internet. So if you're going to get a message, you're not going to get it because your phone is not working. There's complete lack of electricity and charging, you know, to charge your phone or to receive messages. But there were flyers in the neighborhoods, and as you remember, it's not an open field where the Hamas fighters are standing there, and the Israelis are there. Hamas are among buildings, and the Israelis' policy was, shoot first, ask later. So, if they see a bullet or anything comes in, that neighborhood is bombed. Evidence was when three of their hostages, if you will, at one point, they came out speaking in Hebrew and waving the white flag, and they were afraid of them, and they thought it was a booby trap. And unfortunately, the situation led to their demise. That's a simple example.
What? So, okay, when you were there in December, when you were in Gaza in December, you were there for how long?
7 days.
7 days, and then what about March?
7 days. And
were you able to communicate with your family back home? Were they terrified?
In December, it was much worse. As I said, the internet was sparse. I had a communication with my wife, and if she doesn't get a text from me in 24 hours, to let the State Department be aware of that. So yes, it was very scary.
We want to be respectful of your time, so we have only a couple more questions. One is about your experience as a doctor there. I mean, in those unthinkably, unfathomably difficult conditions, how do you remain focused? How emotionally frying is the experience of working in a hospital with a flashlight operating on mothers and children? How are you able to keep going? And you were sick both times.
You have to keep in mind, while I was there and privileged to be there for 1 week, these people over there had been trapped there for 6 months. The first time I was rattled, to be honest, hearing the bombing. When you live here, you live comfortably without any noise. I was rattled and scared. But living with these 50,000 people and seeing half of them are kids, somehow you have to grow strength. And after a while, you really start thinking of yourself as different than these people. So that was the way I started thinking of it. And I just continued to get up, go in, operate until I can sleep, and help as much as we can.
So you've got essentially this lawless situation, no electricity, no school, no real economy. How do people in Gaza spend their time?
It's a very, very good question. Most of the people spend their time trying to find food. At one point, remember the United States and Jordan were dropping aid, and there were kids who were just trying to follow the drop-offs, and several got killed because they were falling on top of them. Some packages fell in the water, and they had to swim to get it because they were starving, and instead they drowned. So most of the people are just doing everything they can to survive, to find food wherever they can. They stand in a line for food for a mile. Just the basic things that you and I think about and get upset if you're in a line for 5 minutes to get a Starbucks coffee. These people are spending hours to barely get their daily supplies.
I've got to ask two more quick questions. One is...
I'm all ears.
Okay, well, appreciate that. One is, I'm reminded of the sequel. We were just talking about All Quiet on the Western Front the other day and other, you know, Deer Hunter, where there are sequences where you go from warlike conditions to back home, to peace, to everyday life. How do you adjust from the weeks you spent in Gaza, and again, these unfathomably dark conditions, to then life as normal in Durham, North Carolina?
To be honest with you, it's been really hard. When I left the first time, I was wrestling so hard with guilt. Here I am living, and these people are dying, and they have no access to a lot of stuff. I took a shower in Istanbul, Turkey, because they have the lounge, and just feeling the warm water, I was like, wow. I never had an appreciation of a shower for so long. So kind of that sense of huge guilt I'm wrestling with. I remember I had a nice meal when I was in first class, and I looked at it for almost an hour before the meal, because I was like, how can I eat this? And these kids that haven't had food and die from malnutrition can't. I finally got myself to eat it, and the mental struggle continued. And yes, I got in, I landed, I took the call, and I was operating and busy. But being able to compartmentalize it was tough. I'd sleep for 4 hours or 2 hours and wake up at 2 in the morning because of the time interval and try to contact the people over there to see how to facilitate things. You know, check on them. So it's hard. It's really difficult. And you're not the same ever. Forget humans, just think of an animal. If you walk and you see an animal, a dog that's injured and dying, I mean, you'll stop your car, you'll get out and pick up that dog, you'll get to the vet, you'll take care of it, you know. You spend all your time and energy trying to care for that animal.
My final question is, what have you learned, a very broad one, what have you learned about humans, seeing them in their most destitute state?
Most people are resilient and they can improvise as a provider. But one thing I learned, I had and I met pregnant women delivering babies and have delivered babies, and they're not going to have enough milk to feed their kids, and they look at you. They really felt sorry for what happened on October 7th, because there's innocent civilians that died on October 7th, kids, not many, women, and things happened. But the scale in Gaza is much, much bigger. I think we're all human beings. Once you take the politics out, because most people don't want to think of politics, they want to live normal lives.
Well, Dr. Hassan, that note, we can't thank you enough for talking to us. This has been eye-opening for us, and we're sure for our audience. And, you know, we wish you all the best going back there, that you stay safe and continue to do the great work that you're doing.
Thank you, Dr. Hassan. Wow.
If you guys can help us somehow, because again, there's a lot of things we can do. You all have a large audience. If we can somehow organize, and instead of these destructive protests that are going on in campuses and universities, it doesn't serve anyone. If you put all that energy together to help the people there, I think it would carry much, much more weight.